You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The first time Sandra Day O'Connor walked up the steps to the Supreme Court, it was as a tourist. And the second time she walked those steps, she made history as the first woman on the Supreme Court. She served nearly 25 years, and now that she's retired, she says she wants to convey her understanding of how the court evolved and how it represents so much more than what the day's headlines can capture. So she's written a book called Out of Order, Stories from the History of the Supreme Court. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased it has brought Sandra Day O'Connor to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And you call yourself the FWOTSC, the first woman on the Supreme Court, because as you write, everything important in Washington, D.C. has an acronym.
Yeah.
A lot of people must ask you what it was like to be the FWOTSC. And what do you usually answer?
Well, that's hard to say. It's hard to describe. It was a role like no other because there hadn't been a predecessor. There was a great deal of attention paid to the first woman.
You write that Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American justice, brought a special perspective to the court because of the things he had seen. Did being a woman ever affect the way you thought about certain cases?
Well, it probably did. I can't analyze it. I'm too close to it. But undoubtedly, it had some kind of effect, just as it would on my personality and my nature.
You pay homage to female trailblazers before you, like Lucille Lohman, the first woman law clerk at the Supreme Court. How did she find her way to that job? Because there was so much resistance to hiring women.
Yes, but I think she was hired at a time when we were maybe at war and it was harder to find a law clerk. And so the justice put a woman on.
And she was hired in 1944. And then another female clerk wouldn't be hired until over 20 years later.
Isn't that amazing?
So did the justices or the people who did the hiring see this as an all-boys club?
The justices did the hiring, and I don't think they saw it as an all-boys club. But in fact, that's all they were hiring was men. And of course, in those days, you were more apt to have a vastly greater number of male law students than female. So your pool of candidates for women would have been smaller than it is today.
But that didn't matter when Justice Felix Frankfurter, who had hired the first African-American law clerk, had an opportunity to hire Ruth Bader Ginsburg 10 years later, even though she tied for first in her class at Columbia Law School.
Yes, I know.
So I have a feeling that there was a feeling, you know, we don't want any girls in here.
Well, I don't think it
make
was
us
that
uncomfortable.
Consciously, but just there was no pressure on anybody to hire women, and there were fewer women candidates for the job.
Do you feel your appointment helped change the federal court culture even?
There is no question that it did, and it helped change opportunities for women generally. It really did. I'm not saying that because it was me. The idea that we had a woman law clerk just made a huge difference for opportunities for women lawyers.
So there are more female clerks today?
Oh, my. There are as many women as men today as law clerks.
Well, other firsts were also slow to catch on. For instance, the first Catholic justice was appointed in 1836, and then not another one for 60 years?
I didn't know that.
Today, there are six Catholic justices.
Yes.
They represent the majority on the court.
Yes,
maybe
today,
they'll vote
that's true.
On who should be the next pope as well. You also write about Belva Lockwood. Who was she?
Well, she was a woman lawyer in the early days, and she was quite remarkable. I think maybe she argued the first case at the court. I'd have to look back and see.
Well, the law was actually required before she was allowed to argue in federal court.
Yes.
So a woman couldn't argue in federal court?
Just you had to move for admission to practice before the Supreme Court, and I guess there weren't many women out there asking for that permission.
Well, one of the things you get from this book is we think of the Supreme Court as such an important institution today, but it didn't get much respect at the beginning. John Jay, in fact, the first Chief Justice quit almost immediately afterward to become governor of New York?
Well, the problem in those days was twofold. One, the court wasn't particularly well known, so it didn't have the kind of respect it does today. But second, the justices were required to, as I put it, ride the circuit. And that was a horrible assignment. It meant that the members of the court had to go sit all over the country to hear the cases. They were not all heard at the U.S. Supreme Court.
And we're not talking about airplanes.
We didn't have airplanes.
So they were going by horse back all over the country.
Yes. And that was a nightmarish kind of a job. We didn't have hotels. We didn't have motels. I mean, it was horrible. They didn't have good places to stay. They had very poor transportation. It was miserable for
And
them.
Jay believed the court would never amount to much.
Yes, he saw this kind of difficulty that the court faced, and he just thought it was pretty impossible to overcome.
So you write, in reflecting on the court's humble early days, it is striking to note how dramatically the court and its practices have evolved and how so much of that evolution was born of struggle and serendipity. Serendipity?
Well, meaning whatever happened, happened. What the cases that came to the court and were heard were not in any organized way. It just sort of happened. Somebody would apply and the court might or might not take it.
But the court took on powers that may not have been imagined.
Well, that's
initially.
Right. Yes, over so time they did.
You also write that a federal court functions as an outsider to the system of majority will. If the framers of the Constitution were intent on creating a democratic government, why do you think that they created such a powerful institution, or at least theoretically powerful institution, to be made up of unelected officials with lifetime appointments?
Yes, but in theory, if you have a Supreme Court to decide ultimately a legal issue, federal issue of law, it's not surprising that it might have had the kind of history that our court has had. And it's a huge power that the court has. And I don't think people recognized that in the early days.
And today there are people who sometimes feel that it's a mistake to let the court make certain kinds of decisions, that certain things should be voted upon or should be the will of Congress rather than the court.
Well, perhaps, but I think when you limit the court's power to deciding issues of law, it's quite understandable that that's what the court does, and I think the great majority of American people accept that.
My guest is Sandra Day O'Connor. Her latest book, I can say that. This is your third book, right?
Yes.
Out of Order.
And a couple of children's books, too.
Out of Order, Stories from the History of the Supreme Court.
Yes.
It is published by Random House. You dedicate a whole chapter to the relationship between the president and the court, which has often been tumultuous. Didn't an argument between Thomas Jefferson and his cousin, John Marshall, end up establishing the power of the court?
Those two did not get along. Here they were cousins, and they were both very smart, and they were both leaders, but they had very different beliefs. And it's amazing that we came through that as well as we did.
And then Abe Lincoln defied a direct court order.
He did what?
Didn't he defy a direct court order?
Oh, I think he did a time or two.
Mm-hmm. And yet you write that modern historians have made clear that Lincoln never tried to suppress political dissent. So is there something still at stake in his decision?
Oh, I don't think so. But he lived at a time when we were still forming our country in a very real sense, and he had issues to face that we don't face today.
And the court at that time seemed rather political. It made a number of decisions.
Yes, it seemed somewhat distant as well.
A number of decisions that supported slavery at a time when public opinion was moving in another direction.
Yes, that's true.
Last week, the Obama administration submitted a brief to the Supreme Court in an effort to help overturn California's Proposition 8. Is it unusual for a president to petition the court in that way?
No. I mean, the president does petition occasionally to have an issue heard at the court, so I don't regard that as terribly unusual.
Well, in this case, we're talking about something that involves one state rather than a national
problem. Well, yes, but the issue behind it will affect many states, all of them. So it doesn't matter that it's one state that's party to a case. The principle decided will affect them all.
One surprising fact about the court is that nowhere in the Constitution or other legislation does it require that there be nine justices. Where did that number come from in the first place?
Well, it's set by Congress, and Congress could change it. But it's been nine for a long time now, and I see no move afoot to propose a change in that. It seems to have served us rather well, but it certainly didn't have to be that number.
But when FDR suggested...
he wanted to change it.
Changing it to 15, everybody was outraged, and now it is described as one of his biggest mistakes.
Well, could be, but FDR at the time wanted a different ruling from the court, and he thought the way to get it was to enlarge it and appoint all the new justices, and he'd get the ruling that he wanted.
I suspect there have been other presidents who've had the same kinds of thoughts over the
years. Yeah, but I don't think many of them had thought they had that much power.
And then the Supreme Court is in this very impressive building, but it didn't have a permanent home until 1935.
It was a long time before it got the courthouse.
So where did it meet?
Well, it met all over the place. It met in New York and Philadelphia and different places. And it just didn't have a home of its own. It was a long time coming.
Did the court decide what cases to hear similarly in the old days?
Yes, the members of the court themselves had to decide what cases it was going to accept for hearing, just as they do today.
You write about the role of the Senate in appointing federal judges. What is its responsibility?
To confirm the selection.
You write about the first confirmation battle over Chief Justice nominee John Rutledge, who was rejected by the Senate after he said
that
he'd rather George Washington die than he signed the Jay Treaty.
I know. He was very critical of the Jay Treaty, as many people were.
But Washington had appointed him to the court.
Yes, I know.
So is that case particularly important, or is that just one of those odd historic facts?
Interesting from the standpoint of history. I don't think it affects much about what we're doing today.
Well, there's the whole matter of qualifications.
Yes.
And in those days, you didn't have to be a lawyer to be appointed to this.
No, you don't have to be a lawyer today. But I think you'd have a hard time getting confirmed.
Some critics of the current court argued that too many cases are decided by political rather than legal argument. Do you agree, or is this, if it's true, has it always been part of the...
No, I don't. I think the court for a good many years now has been very careful to deal with the legal arguments and not rest on political grounds. I think they're good about that.
Much has been made of Justice Antonin Scalia's comment that framed the Voting Rights Act as legislation that perpetuated racial entitlements. Something that Justice Sonia Sotomayor responded to by saying that voting is not a racial entitlement. But if a justice is willing to be so open about controversial ideas like that in an open court, I wonder what sorts of things are said when you're just talking amongst yourselves.
Well, probably more of the same.
Were you ever shocked by some of the things that people said and just trying to talk through an issue?
I suppose occasionally I was surprised, but generally speaking, not. I mean, generally speaking, they turn on legal issues that we've heard stated in the lower courts already, and we're prepared when we come in for the arguments on both sides.
And often precedence is a major factor, but we've seen a lot of decisions.
It is the major factor.
But in recent years, we've seen a lot of precedents overturned.
Not a lot, but occasionally some are.
Well, what are the reasons for that if the precedent seemed to be working well?
Well, if it's working well, I don't think the court's going to overturn it.
Well, Citizens United, for example, I'm not asking you to argue the case here, but a lot of people were shocked that the court went against many, many years of precedent.
Well, in some aspect of it, perhaps, but that can happen. If the present members of the court feel that some principle of law that the court has been following for a long time is out and out wrong, they might see fit at some point to try to change that principle.
There was a time when people called you the most powerful woman on the court because you were seen as the swing voter.
Did
you
think
of yourself?
I didn't like that term.
You didn't like being thought of that way?
No, I mean, the symbol of that is somebody that just swings back and forth. It doesn't matter where or why. You're just on a ride. And I didn't like to think of myself in that fashion.
I don't think that's what was intended. They were seeing the court as divided four and four, with you as somebody who might decide either way. Well,
in any event, when the court is divided 5-4, that's the result. You have a majority of one, and that's a pretty narrow majority.
Do you see the court's role as a more important check against excesses by the executive branch or the legislative branch?
It could be either. It's just the top court for determining legal principles that govern what we do as a nation.
Do you, when you look back at your 25 years in the court, are there some decisions? I know other justices have talked about this. They regretted that they had voted a certain way on a certain decision, and
well,
of course there's nothing
so,
you can do
but
and change
I haven't
it.
Gone back to look at it that way and say and review all my decisions and say, now are there some I wish I hadn't decided that way. I haven't gotten to that. Maybe I will, but I haven't done that.
But you don't even think about it?
No, I don't.
You're right that different presidents also look for different qualities in potential justices. For instance, George Washington wanted men who had served in the Revolutionary War and who supported the Federalist cause and the Constitution, while President Obama stated that he wants justices to not only be sharp thinkers, but to identify with people's hopes and struggles as an essential ingredient for arriving at just decisions and outcomes. To what extent are appointments signs of the times?
Well, I think they are. I mean, a president is asked to fill a vacancy on the court, that president is likely to try to find as a justice someone whose views coincide largely with the president's own. And he might be very interested to know what the candidate's views are and try to select on that basis. That's not surprising.
In this book, you reveal all sorts of things about the court that people might not be aware of. One underreported Supreme Court tradition is that the most junior justice serves on the court's cafeteria committee.
Yes, that's been the custom for a while.
That's like a rookie on the football team.
I know. It's not a very good appointment, is it?
So,
in terms of a committee, that wouldn't be one you'd probably go looking for.
So what is Elena Kagan asked to do?
What did she ask?
No, what is she asked to do as the junior member of the court right now?
Well, I think she was chairing the cafeteria committee. So if there were some problem with our court's cafeteria, it might be referred to her initially to give us a report.
And then she would say to them, you know, she'd say to the people in the cafeteria, enough of these, the frozen yogurt, let's have more pretzels.
I don't think it's come down to that. But if there were some problems there with hours of operation or service of some kind, she might inquire into it and give us a report.
And I also was surprised to learn that there's a supreme basketball court above the court where you presided.
There isn't. It's just that the space above the courtroom has a high-ceilinged room. The highest spot in the land in the courthouse is one where they've put a couple of basketball hoops up. And so the clerks and sometimes a justice or two will go up there and toss a ball around.
Well, Byron
and
White
we call
was,
it the highest court in the land, and Byron White did that when he was on the court.
Well, he had been a jock when he was
well,
college.
Yes, he was
he
a great athlete.
He even played in the NFL, didn't he?
I don't know, but he was a very gifted athlete.
You write, there are three broad categories of reasons for which most justices have left the court. The first is death in office. But what about your retirement? Was that a difficult decision to make?
Well, it was in a way, but I had been there 25 years, and my husband, John, had Alzheimer's and was quite ill and had reached the stage in life when it was clear he needed to be in a care center full time. And we had two of our three sons living in Arizona, and it seemed to me that it was best if we put him in a care center in Arizona, and I thought it would be best if I were there also.
Do justices think about when they might choose to retire, who the president is and who is likely to replace
them?
Well,
they probably do. If there were someone serving as president and you were serving as a justice and you didn't particularly want that president picking your successor, you might try to delay for a while.
Did you do that?
I don't think I did.
You still occasionally sit on courts of appeals, don't you?
Yes, I do.
So how does that work? They say, and now we bring in as a relief pitcher Sandra Day O'Connor, formerly of the Supreme Court.
Well, the particular circuit can let me know if they would like my services to sit on a group of cases that they're going to decide. And if I do, then they notify the lawyers who are handling those cases that in this case the panel will be so-and-so, and they'd include my name.
Now, you also talk about some notable justices of the past, and you're right that some of our most memorable judges, like Stephen Field and William O. Douglas, were known more for their larger-than-life personalities than for their work as jurists. But wasn't Douglas a really influential justice?
Well, maybe not among the members of the court, but in terms of long-term effect, he might have been. Mm-hmm. But he was quite a traveler and quite an adventurer, and that seemed to matter to him a great deal.
And there are some larger-than-life type characters on the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Do they get heard more when the justices are discussing how they might vote?
No, I don't think so. Everybody has an equal voice. You can sit there and say what you think, which is quite nice.
And how influential are the law clerks in helping you make those decisions?
Well, law clerks can do great research and uncover precedents that the justice might not have been aware were out there and can be very helpful in that regard.
And you've dedicated this book to your law clerks.
Yes, because I've loved having my law clerks. They've been great. I've enjoyed them so much through the years.
And you interview them the same as you might
interview
anybody for a job?
I certainly do.
Do you? I'm sure you miss it on some level because you were in the middle of the action.
Well, yes, you miss that. But I thought that I had done it for quite a few years, like 25. And that's fair enough. And I don't think we need to subject the nation to the services of an ancient justice.
Well, most of the judges get pretty old.
Well, they might if they have good health.
Now, the review in the Today's Times remarked on the fact that you really didn't get into political issues here. You seem to be reluctant to talk about some of the big issues that the court has been facing recently. Why is that?
Well, because I think I don't want, as a retired justice, to speak out in ways that would be seen as an attempt to influence the court. I had my years there.
Some of the other retired justices have done that. They've said, you know, I'm really disappointed with this latest decision.
Well, I hope that I don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I don't think that's my role.
So what is your role these days? Are you going to write another book?
What?
Are you going to write another book?
Well, I don't know. I might write one about how the cowgirl got to the court. That might be of interest to some.
A memoir.
Yes. Just about that aspect. Mm,
because you did write another memoir. That was your first book, wasn't it?
Yes.
This one is called Out of Order, Stories from the History of the Supreme Court. It is published by Random House. And it has been my great pleasure to have Sandra Day O'Connor as my guest today on our show.
It's been a nice opportunity to be here. Thank you.